Between the onslaught of federal immigration enforcement and organized resistance to it, Minneapolis is being pushed to the brink. What made Minneapolis more of a crucible than other cities? Do anti-ICE protesters have a right to carry arms into the turmoil? Does the state of Minnesota have a right to resist federal agents? Can the powder keg be defused? We will tackle these questions and more on today's episode of Independent Conversations. Hello, everybody. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you from the Independent Institute in Oakland, California. And I've got colleagues and experts with me today who can shed some light. Let me start with a question to Dr. Abigail Hall, our senior fellow, who recently published a piece on our website, independent.org, titled Governance at Gunpoint. Dr. Hall, or Abby, if I may, before we get into the current details about Minneapolis, can you give us a little historical perspective? Have we been here before?
So in some ways, we certainly have, though Minneapolis is the most recent example where we see U.S. federal agents being used as a force against civilians. This is certainly not the first time. So if we want to go back just a few months, we were talking not about Minneapolis, but we were talking about Los Angeles. And if you want to go further back in history, particularly within the context of, say, the Vietnam War, there's a long history of utilizing National Guard troops. In more contemporary contexts, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, or Department of Homeland Security, DHS personnel. But we've absolutely been here before. And so it's important for us to contextualize this to understand that we have some context for understanding what's happening in Minneapolis and what may yet happen based on what we've observed throughout history.
Which means when federal law enforcement is deployed internally, things go wrong. I think that's your point, isn't it?
Yes. So in the piece that you referenced specifically, we highlight a couple of kind of well-known or rather infamous cases, the big one being, of course, Kent State, in which case you have the National Guard who's opening fire against students, killing several and wounding several others. But we've seen this type of dynamic before. When you utilize federal troops as a civilian police-keeping force or to engage with civilians, we have these very predictable outcomes in terms of violence against civilians, inappropriate use of force, and questions about not only things like legality, but what is the ultimate purpose of these agencies? Is it to enforce laws abroad? Is it to enforce things domestically? And questions about what types of tools and tactics and personnel should be conducting these types of operations domestically?
So I think also we have to bear in mind the founders of the United States and what their thinking was, and they, you know, fought the military, unless there was a true insurrection, should be protecting the borders, engaging in declared wars. And the police power, on their thinking, belonged to the states and localities. So as federal claims of jurisdiction and congressional actions have and presidential initiatives have expanded the use of federal policing, it's somewhat moving away from what the founders might well have expected, and even the people who founded the Border Patrol. I mean, when it was founded in the 1920s, the congressman who was the co-author of the bill said, oh, we're never going to have these people arresting people away from the border.
Right. It's an actual border patrol as opposed to what's operating essentially as an inland police force now with military elements. And to echo some of these points about the founding, I mean, look at the major grievances that the colonists had against the British Empire. It was all about stationing troops on the streets of Boston. And there are armed conflicts in this. The Boston Massacre is the most famous one. And even though the soldiers that fired into the crowd are eventually exonerated on the grounds that they were acting in self-defense, nonetheless, that confrontation came about because they were putting military troops on the streets, quartering them in houses, having them go door to door and do policing functions. That's just a recipe for conflict.
Yeah. I think you're right to bring up founding. The thing that I would point out to people as well is that even past the founding, you have very clear attempts to try to separate federal military forces from civilian police-keeping forces, namely the implementation of the Posse Comitatus Act in the 1860s, which very, very explicitly prohibits the use of military as a civilian policekeeping force. Now, of course, when we're talking about ICE or we're talking about DHS, we're not talking about the military specifically, but the spirit is the same in terms of having, again, federalized troops operating within a civilian context.
Well, regarding the Border Patrol, isn't it the case, Bill, that Congress, although initially restricting its jurisdiction to being close to the border, increasingly expanded its legal authorization to operate inside the country, the Border Patrol itself?
Yes, there was one expansion in 1965, and there was another later. So essentially, Congress has allowed them to operate everywhere.
Which was probably a mistake they should have foreseen the problems of, right, Abby?
I think so. So I know I'm based out of Florida, and I think our entire state, for the most part, falls under the jurisdiction of Customs.
Because right, that 100 miles,
yeah.
So they have power within the 100 miles. They can have set up checkpoints and all sorts of things like that, but they can arrest people, or if they see a crime, enforce the law anywhere.
Yes.
So but within the 100 miles from either the ground, the land border, or the sea, they have these extra powers.
Yeah, and I think many people don't realize just exactly then how far those expanded powers of Customs and Border Patrol actually reach, because then when I start to say things like my entire state falls under those enhanced parameters of CPB, people are very surprised. But then you start thinking about, well, what other cities are within 100 miles of a border of the U.S.? And
lots.
You'll find that there is a lot of them. Pick your favorite city on the eastern seaboard. You're talking about one within 100 miles of the border.
And or so, the western seaboard.
I think Pittsburgh might be exempt.
They might be.
Phil. So if you think about it, there are parts of the country that are surrounded by borders. It's anywhere that touches the ocean, anywhere that touches the Gulf of Mexico, anywhere that touches the Canada or Mexico borders. If you go to the center of the country, yes, maybe Wyoming is outside of that 100-mile zone. But think about one of the implications here. ICE is also claiming to operate outside of a lot of the standard constitutional norms against searches and seizures, things that would apply to the regular like town police force or the state police, even in your operation, or the federal FBI. They're claiming because of this border jurisdiction that they're a special unit that operates under a different set of rules, and yet they're conducting policing well inland of the border in major metropolitan areas that large percentages of our population live. That seems to be a constitutional problem.
So one of these issues has to do with warrants, and another has to do with habeas corpus. So it's too complicated for us to get a warrant from a judge, so we're just going to sign our own warrants without external review. And then they're saying, so some of the people that have been picked up have claimed habeas corpus. You know, where are we and what are we being held for? And at least Stephen Miller and some other people say, it doesn't apply to us.
Is that claim because the people that they are seeking to secure and maybe deport are people who are not U.S. citizens and are not entitled to claim habeas corpus? Is that the basis for that claim, do you think?
That certainly seems to be Miller's argument there. I don't think there's any jurisprudence that really upholds that. And you overlay it with the fact there have been multiple instances of U.S. citizens who've been picked up in like a Target parking lot, or people that are, and they're being told, well, now you have to carry your passport to walk through New York City. Which seems
unbelievable.
Very much the direction of paper.
Pictures in the New York Times of people with that kind of name tag thing that you...
A lanyard.
Lanyard around your neck, and they have the passport, their U.S. passport showing on the outside. So yeah. They're not going to get stopped as they're walking around.
I mean, certainly, whether or not non-citizens can claim the right of habeas corpus under the Constitution, if federal agents are just willy-nilly invoking exemption from that restriction, it's going to overflow and hit citizens regardless. I mean, it just seems like a risky way to go about it, because inevitably you're going to violate the rights of citizens, even if you think you're only going to violate the rights of non-citizens.
Yeah, and this is something that comes up a lot when we study not only domestic policy, but foreign policy as well, is that there tends to be this idea that policy that is targeted at the quote-unquote other group, whether we're talking about, say, you know, illegal immigrants within the context of the U.S. borders, or if we're talking about Al-Qaeda or some other terrorist operation abroad, there tends to be this thought that these, you know, tools, tactics, and techniques being utilized against these other populations are wholly targeted in those locations or toward those people and those people only. The reality of the situation, however, is that what we find over and over and over again is that those tools of intervention being deployed against other people very consistently come to be used at home against U.S. civilians. And this, again, is something where we see a lot of historical examples, including more contemporary ones. So looking at things like the use of cell site simulators or stingrays in the context of Minneapolis or other types of tracking devices. These are things that were developed for use abroad, but are now being used domestically. And even under the best case scenario, where say you're using a cell site simulator, where if people are unfamiliar, it's basically a relatively small device that picks up cell phone data from individual cell phones. In theory, you're supposed to have a warrant to be using them, but they're not particularly well regulated. And they pick up cell signals. In theory, you can track, you know, criminals or people that you're trying to apprehend if you're law enforcement, but the instruments are not that precise. You wind up picking up everybody's cell phone signal within a particular area where these things are operating. And so when people have this idea that citizens are not going to be actively involved, I think that's remarkably wishful thinking at best, but also just painfully naive based on what we know historically.
Here's one thing that I'm confused about regarding Minneapolis in particular. So are the activities of ICE and Border Patrol there, have they been carrying out what you could call an undifferentiated sweep of people who are potentially in the country illegally, potentially asylum seekers, without distinguishing any of them which are violating our criminal laws? Or have they been trying to focus exclusively on those who may be in the country illegally but have violated the criminal laws, like, you know, theft, murder, et cetera? Has it been undifferentiated, or are these federal agents distinguishing between hard criminals and mere illegal entrants?
So the problem is that President Trump and his staff have talking out of two sides of their mouth. So some of the time, it's the worst of the worst, the murderers, the rapists, the child molesters, and they are very often targeting those. But on the other hand, when he ran for office, and you can see some polling data that supports some of this, especially when you're polling Republicans, they talk about mass deportation. So people like Stephen Miller talk about deporting 3,000 people a day. Well, if you're just doing the targeted criminals, people who have committed serious crimes, you're not going to get 3,000 a day. So you have to, if you're aiming at mass deportation, you have to have what you might call collateral damage or something like that. You have to be sweeping everybody in the vicinity up and deporting them also. And so that's the problem. And they're also, you know, related to this is exactly, or places where people that are day laborers congregate, or people that, even non-construction sites, but where there's a lot of maybe Latinos who are hired for one reason or another, a hotel, yeah, picking fruit. Yeah. So then there's the related issue of prisons and people in custody, which we could get into. I don't know if that's the right order for you, Graham.
Well, Bill, yesterday I asked you a question. I asked you what I thought was a simple question. Is it a crime to enter the United States illegally? Leaving aside murder,
I think it's a civil offense.
Rather than?
A criminal offense, like a felony or something like that. So there's another question, though, that has been constantly brought up, and that is, well, they have somebody in custody. We want to know if they're an illegal alien, and particularly if they're in jail, we want to get them either at the end of their sentence or in the middle of their sentence and deport them. So Minnesota completely cooperates with ICE. There is the state of Minnesota. They completely cooperate. Now, they also have county jails, of course. So the counties have a freedom under their government, their constitution, their statutes, to cooperate or not. So there are like 85 counties in Minnesota, and most of them cooperate. 10 of them don't. Okay, so that includes
Hennepin.
That includes the county.
Minneapolis.
Minneapolis is in, but that is not up to the mayor. That's not up to the mayor. It's actually a decision by the sheriff. It's not the governor. It's not the mayor. It's the sheriff. And there's two possible reasons. He might just have political reasons. His constituency doesn't want this. But some of the time, you don't cooperate with federal agencies in an assertive way because you want the local community to cooperate with you. So let's say there's a domestic dispute or a small robbery or something like that. They won't call up police if they think they're going to be put in a deportation dragnet. So that might be another reason.
Phil, you were about to add something that I think I overrode you on.
Yeah, it's just basically the whole nature of the way that they're sweeping is, the Trump administration has essentially acted as if they're issuing quotas from above, up the numbers, because they want to tout that to constituencies. And yet that just incentivizes going after the easiest illegal immigrants to round up. So that's where they go after the day laborers at the construction site rather than chasing down the hardened criminals. Yeah, it matters quite a bit for the policy's reception among the public because within the polling data, Trump went into office, there was probably a majority that was in favor of a stricter border policy than we had under Biden. That seems to be clear. But if you dig into the polling data and fine-grained questions, if they ask the question, do you support deporting illegal immigrants that have been convicted of a crime? And that's like the vast majority of the country across both parties says yes. But if you start asking questions, do you support deporting an illegal immigrant who is married to an American citizen? That's actually very unpopular. Do you support deporting someone who arrived here when they were a baby and has been living in the United States? That's also unpopular. Do you support deporting someone who is an immediate relative of a U.S. citizen? That's unpopular. And it's that latter group that seems to be gathered up when they do these mass raids on construction sites, often in very militarized ways, guns drawn and body armor and the black SUVs rolling up, everything we've been seeing on TV. That's eroding away the public popularity of what initially was one of Trump's stronger issues of strengthening border enforcement. Now he's in the negative nationwide on polling because people are not liking what they see, and I think with good reason.
Here's a a devil's advocate kind of question. Let's say a MAGA person is listening to this, might say, so you're saying it's okay to be in the country illegally as long as you don't violate our criminal laws. And then how do we respond to that person?
So I think that there are a couple of ways that you could approach this question. So I'm certainly would not be in agreement on the super strict immigration or tightening immigration enforcement immigrants have built the economy. They continue to contribute to our economy. And the data backs this up consistently. They contribute more than they withdraw in terms of federal support. And in terms of criminals, your own children, and by your own, I mean citizens, were more likely to be criminals than recent immigrants are. And so if based on the data, what we see is that new immigrants are less likely to engage in criminal behavior than native-born citizens. It's not until you get to those initial immigrants' grandchildren, i.e. U.S. citizens who have no memory of immigration or don't have that immediate connection through their parents, do you see those crime rates level off. So if the goal is to make us safer, and I think that if you are talking to anyone, whether they're left, right, or center, we all want oftentimes very similar things. We want safe communities. We want to know who is here, what are they doing? And those are all, I think, again, reasonable things to want. The question is what policy or policies are most effective at achieving those goals? And these widespread immigration sweeps are not going to do anything to meaningfully decrease the crime rate. And certainly they're not going to do anything. And one of the things that Phil had said earlier reminded me of this, the kind of knock-on effects to this or the spillover effects are not insignificant. They're not trivial. I know within my own state, we've seen a lot of school districts that have had their enrollments drop. These are kids who are not getting educated. That has effects going on well into the future. It has impacts on our domestic economy in terms of things like tourism and our hotel industry. There are all of these things that very much matter that we also need to think about and kind of step back a little bit from this overarching, just very blunt policy discussion.
I like the way you emphasize practical effects. That could be persuasive even to people who might disagree with you on some points. For example, my hypothetical MAGA of a few moments ago, I was just thinking of a hypothetical answer, which is maybe. No, we're not saying that you can enter the country illegally anytime you want, so long as you don't violate our criminal laws. What we are saying, maybe, is that the effort to root out and deport all the non-criminal illegal entrance will have spillover effects and consequences that are more negative than is justified.
Also, we could imagine another immigration policy. I mean, of course, in the 19th century, we had very open immigration, but you could have meritocratic immigration. You could have bounty, or, you know, you could have to have a bond of some sort to come in the country. You could have to say, I have a job, or you could prove that it's very likely that you would get a job. There's a lot of ways that could be a regularized, fairly open immigration, but not swamping things in a way that was, you know, really disruptive of the society.
If we look at our immigration laws over the past 60, 70 years, they're a complete bureaucratic mess. And people hear the term illegal immigrant, they think it's like a black-white category. Either you're here legally or you're not. The reality is, over the years, we've had all this bureaucratic accretion of some very ambiguous statuses around refugees that arrived. Maybe they were legal when they arrived, but later they lost that refugee status. What do you do in that type of a situation? That's a very different case than like a drug smuggler coming across the border in the middle of the night while they're committing a crime. And yet, if the policy response to them is deport them all, use the same show of force against them all, that's going to start getting into some really troubling legal territory and ethical territory.
Also, there are people that were vetted when they got a visa, and then they've overstayed their visa. There are millions of people who have overstayed their visas, but it's not that we don't know who they are or that they're, a lot of them are student visas or work visas of some sort.
And some of those people are already in the court system trying to work out their visa status, or they're in the bureaucracy waiting for a hearing. And it's like, okay, well, you go arrest them and deport them midway through that procedure. You're violating the course of the procedure itself.
So let's go to a topic which is even more inflammatory, maybe literally in some cases, the reaction to, the resistance to these enforcement protocols. In Minneapolis in particular, there's organized resistance. It seems to be encouraged by the governor and the mayor. There's Ice Watch, which has organized professional trainings. They watch, they heckle, they identify, crowds gather wherever ICE is operating, and in some cases, apparently, seek to obstruct. What are we to make of this resistance movement? It seems to be gaining steam.
I have a few thoughts on this one. Definitely contentious, if we're being very polite. I think that the U.S. federal government is learning the same lesson as Napoleon and the Russians. You don't invade a winter people in the winter. It goes badly for you. The organized resistance, I think, and even the other kind of just individual forms of protest that we're seeing coming out of Milwaukee are really interesting from a perspective of kind of studying modern day resistance, because we're seeing how people are coordinating, how these networks are coming together. You have people, you know, making noise outside of hotels where ICE agents are staying. You have people who are setting off their car alarms from inside their houses to alert their neighbors that ICE is in the neighborhood. And you're seeing these kinds of, again, formal, semi-formal as well as informal networks that are really pushing back against this. And the thing that strikes me about Minneapolis is that you're really witnessing an important perspective of citizenship and what it means to be a citizen within the context of democracy. So whether you support what people in Minneapolis are doing or not, being involved and participating is a cornerstone of the type of democratic society in which we live. And I see the people of Minneapolis as really effectively engaging in citizenship and illustrating a concept that many of us seem to have forgotten or don't give a lot of thought to, which is that policies are only acceptable to the extent that the people on the receiving end of those policies accept them. And here we're seeing what happens when policy does not comport with what it is that the people of a particular area want. And it's very, very clear from the backlash and from some of the internal memos that we've seen from ICE, they were not anticipating this, at least not to this scale. And they're certainly finding out that, hey, this is not going well. We have reports, for example, from within ICE saying that they're having to ask for volunteers to go be a part of Operation Metro Surge in Milwaukee. Why? Because a lot of their internal agents don't want to do it, whether they're anxious about going or they're having some kind of moral qualms about it is not precisely clear. But it's become readily apparent, and we also have Republican lawmakers on the books as saying, hey, if we don't get this under control, this is going to look bad for us within the context of midterms. And so I think there's a lot that we can potentially unpack about this pushback against ICE, as well, of course, the federal government's response to it, as well as the response of local police forces, which is also something that's been interesting to watch.
So I think there's a couple of other aspects of this. So the first is you are absolutely legally entitled to observe. Okay, so these people videotaping or watching or carrying signs nearby or shouting or whatever, that's all legal, but you can't block, you can't impede, you can't get in the way of a law enforcement action. Now, even Stephen Miller has indicated that the ICE and Border Patrol people haven't done enough to separate their law enforcement actions from the nearby people. So they could be carrying portable, you know, sawhorse type things of some sort to separate themselves. And as long as they don't block the people's constitutional rights, they can be separated from them. Now, then there's another aspect of this, and that is the practice of ICE and of Border Patrol has been to attack the observers, to physically attack them. That is, it's not, we haven't found like a written thing or something or an email where they say, go do this. But apparently these law enforcement agents think they're kind of above the law, above the Constitution. And of course they're under, you know, they're maybe scared or something like that, but they attack. And that, I think, is what essentially we saw in the case of Prote, you know, that they attacked the people that were standing there. And the last thing that is related to this was Graham brought up the governor and government officials opposing that. We have the potential here of a breakdown of federalism and even fighting with guns and other things between the federal government and local law and state law enforcement. And that is, well, it's certainly fraught with peril.
Here's a statement that I found in Politico.com from a DHS spokesperson, Tricia McLaughlin. When politicians bar local enforcement from working with us, that is when we have to have a more visible presence so that we can find and apprehend the criminals let out of jails and back into the communities. So they're basically saying that because the local and state governments have been uncooperative, they haven't done the crowd control, for example, that they might have done for ICE, that ICE has been forced to be much more aggressive. This seems like a very convenient way of describing the situation for them. But what do you all think of that?
There are 12 counties in Minnesota where the sheriff allows the local law enforcement to be deputized to a cage in immigration control. And then there are these 10 counties where they don't really cooperate. You're not allowed, the federal government is not allowed to commandeer local governments, state governments. So the state governments are supposed to do their thing and the federal government's supposed to do their thing. Now there's this kind of vague area where people are let go by, you know, they've served their term or they didn't get convicted or they were just stopped temporarily and they're let go. And the question is, the federal law may say, well, you're supposed to do something, but your local authorities say, you know, don't bother to do anything. And that's this area where we're talking about.
Right, that's the area. And when the mayor of the city says, get the F out of Minneapolis, it seems to embolden those who are trying to get ICE, et cetera, out of Minneapolis.
Yeah, in terms of the initial quote that you mentioned, this is kind of a classic move when you look at what happens when federal policies don't go according to plan. So as someone who spends most of their time looking at foreign policy in particular, anytime you have a grand foreign policy failure, which is not infrequently, there is this very kind of clear playbook almost that policymakers go to, which is, I'm going to blame anyone but myself. So this could be blaming your lack of budget, maybe you didn't have adequate personnel because you didn't have enough funding. Or in this particular context, it's the I'm going to blame my supposed partners or allies strategy, which is you didn't help us enough. That's why this is not going according to plan. It has nothing to do with the tools and tactics that we are employing in Minneapolis. It has nothing to do with the individuals or the interactions that people are having. It just has everything to do with the fact that you being, you know, the governor or whoever within these jurisdictions, you're not providing us with enough resources, which is why this is completely falling apart. It's an effective way to try to pass the blame without having to really take any kind of internal accountability.
But Abby, shouldn't it be the province or the responsibility of like local law enforcement to do crowd control in protest opportunities rather than federal agents? And if they had done crowd control, then the federal agents wouldn't have had so much engagement with the crowd.
I mean, certainly that would be the argument. But again, I think we come back to some of those first things that we were talking about, which is even if you have perfect parameters of the police are doing exactly what you, from the perspective of the federal authorities, want them to do, what kinds of tools and tactics are you deploying? Because if you're utilizing military tactics within a civilian context, what the police are doing may or may not be particularly germane to the discussion. And in fact, one of the things that I think we're seeing now, which is particularly telling, is you have videos where police officers in Minnesota are kicking ICE agents off of private property. And so you're having them confronting each other because the police are saying, you don't understand the parameters of the law. You are in violation of the law. And the people who are operating on behalf of the federal authorities don't know enough about the law to understand when they themselves are in violation of it.
It's back to that 100-mile question that we had at the very beginning of the discussion. If ICE is going to assert that it has authority within 100 miles of any border, and not only do that, assert that authority outside of the regular constitutional norms that govern policing at the state and local level, they're inviting a problem for themselves. Because they're already saying, the rules don't apply to us in the same way that the local police are bound by them. They're sidestepping basic norms like getting a warrant or respecting private property or all the procedures and court cases that govern how to execute an arrest. If ICE is saying that rule doesn't apply to us, well, they're automatically inviting these types of conflicts.
Just to clarify, this is sort of technical or in the weeds, and people have been using ICE to cover both the Border Patrol and ICE itself. So ICE, it stands for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and it has always had jurisdiction inside the country. It's never had the 100-mile thing. It was Border Patrol, Customs and Border Patrol, that had originally been, or from early on, confined to the 100-mile thing. So, and that also meant that ICE had more training and experience in urban environments and not forests or deserts or, you know, things that are mainly found along the border.
Phil, since you are kind of our constitutionalist, I just thought I would bring to your attention this essay published a few days ago by Victor Davis Hanson, where he asks, are we slouching toward Fort Sumter in this conflict between state, local, and federal authority in Minneapolis, slouching towards Fort Sumter? So just a quick quote, and then Phil, if you could respond. He says, once sanctuary states, cities, and counties had established the precedent that with impunity they could nullify federal law, then what followed was a logical descent into the current open defiance of the federal government. How odd that self-described progressives are now acting out of the visions of prior kindred nullificationists and neo-Confederates from John C. Calhoun to George Wallace. Is he right that we're slouching toward Fort Sumter, or is he melodramatic?
I think it's a little more on the melodramatic side. What I actually see playing out here is, this federalism is a two-way street. There is an obligation of the federal government to also, their officers, to behave within constitutional norms, just as there is on the state and local government. And we have many issues in our history where they have both violated in different directions. These often come to a head in protest moments. And, you know, the inclination whenever there's a protest is if your side is being wronged, you side with the people that you agree with. And if the protesters are opposite of you, you look down upon the protesters. They're the bad guys. We saw this during COVID and some of the anti-lockdown protests. And then that flipped at Black Lives Matter. I guess basically what I'm getting to is oftentimes the protesters are not causes that you may want to champion yourself, but nonetheless having a basic norm of respecting their rights and knowing where the lines are. That also means something incumbent upon the protesters not to engage in violence, not to block traffic or chain themselves to roadways, as we've seen in a lot of the environmental movement. That exceeds the right to gather in protest. That moves into criminality. Yet at the same time, what we need is a recognition among law enforcement officers of all levels, federal, state, and local, where the boundaries are, where the norms are, where the constitutional rights are. And insofar as one side starts to misbehave, right now I think it's the federal government. There are many instances in the past when it's been state and local government officers that have violated those norms. That's where the problems emerge. And I do see, I guess, in Victor David Sanson, the one partial thing I'll say in his favor is that the conflict that is emerging does come from a breakdown in norms between the state and local level on one hand, and then the federal level on the other hand.
Bill, are we heading toward Fort Sumter?
It's hard to say. I am very concerned that we're heading toward infringement of gun owners' rights.
Oh, let's talk about that piece.
So
that's a tough piece.
I was reminded of this by the fact that Gene Pirro just said, "Don't bring a gun into the District of Columbia."
Yeah, this is
what.
Yeah.
Yeah, a new story this afternoon.
Let's say you have a license to hold a gun in Virginia and in D.C., which you can have. You can have a non-resident gun license in D.C. She says you can't bring it in. That's insanely unconstitutional. So not only did multiple Trump administration people say that Mr. Pretty couldn't have a gun at a demonstration, which is clearly wrong. He wasn't brandishing it, despite some things that were said. And, you know, they haven't really ceased saying stuff like that, despite pushback from Gun Owners of America, from the National Rifle Association, from the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus. So I think we're... You know, it's like martial law kind of thing that's being suggested here.
Yeah, you still have Second Amendment rights, even in conflict and protest situations.
And the Carl Rittenhouse thing exemplifies this problem, where the MAGA people, I don't want to generalize, but certainly some of the people that are now saying crack down were supportive of his right to carry a weapon to defend himself during a protest period. That's the most fun part, to see the left defending the Second Amendment, watching CNN and MS Now defending gun owners' rights and the Second Amendment. They're a little uncomfortable. They're not really sure what the Second Amendment really calls for, but they're now for it, and they want states' rights to have, you know, Minnesota be able to stand up to the federal government.
No, it is really interesting, because I was having a conversation with someone a few days ago how when you have, you know, you're very, like, you know, liberal in the contemporary sense of the term, leftist, agreeing with the NRA, you know that something very strange and very wrong is happening. When it comes to the context of talking about Alex Pretty specifically, I think that the rhetoric that has come out of the White House, especially the things which amount to, if you're going to a protest, like you bring a gun, you're effectively asking for it, is something that should be alarming to absolutely everyone. Even if you have not seen the footage of this, which I have, is that he had it. He wasn't brandishing it. In fact, he was disarmed before he was shot. And so it makes it very difficult, I think, to make a claim then that it was the result of him having a firearm that resulted in his being killed by federal officials. And that really is one thing that I think people are kind of missing in throughout this broader discussion, is that regardless of how you feel about the protest, regardless of how you feel about immigration policy, the fact of the matter is that we have now two people over the course of the last month who have been killed by federal officials in the city of Milwaukee. That is an indisputable statement. We have people who have been killed at the hands of federal authorities. That is the thing that one of the core things to highlight, is that what is happening here, where you have a government that is effectively turning and using lethal force against its own citizenry. And those are kinds of questions that I think we've hit on a lot of the kind of other broader policy questions, you know, about immigration and gun enforcement. But that's the big thing that's kind of undergirding this whole thing that a lot of people, frankly, said are they're missing, I think, the forest through the trees when they're talking about this kind of from a broader perspective.
Well, on a related note there, I mean, you look at the question, best practices in policing. No matter where you are in the country, when an officer is involved in a shooting, the best practice is you bring in a professional team of investigators, you establish a control over the crime scene, you properly and at least attempt to independently figure out what happened here. In both of the incidents in Milwaukee, we had the exact opposite. We had national politicians jumping in to declare guilt before the video's even been reviewed. Trying to frame the narrative, and the narrative was always, well, Alex Priddy, he had a gun with him, therefore he was automatically assumed to be a danger, therefore I guess he deserved to be shot in the eyes of someone like Stephen Miller. This is a clear violation of best practices for law enforcement. I don't care what level you're at, federal, state, or local, because it betrays public trust, and especially when video comes out afterward that contradicts these public statements put out by Stephen Miller and Kristi Noem and even J.D. Vance and Donald Trump themselves were veering in this way in the early responses to this incident. Already they put themselves on the defensive. They have undermined their own credibility. And now, no matter what happens during an investigation going forward, people are not going to trust it. They're going to look at it as either being rigged toward a certain outcome because they've already violated that public trust with the way that they handled it.
We have covered quite a lot of territory here. I'm just impressed by several things that I heard you say. My three experts here said several things that really impressed me. One was when Dr. Abby Hall reminded us that in the United States, we have a really admirable history of nonviolent protest that we should value and not abandon. That was, I think, a good context. And then I was really impressed by the argument that a couple of you made that if ICE and Border Patrol are trying to get all illegal immigrants indiscriminately with regard to their other particular legal statuses, that's going to have spillover effects on people who shouldn't be suffering spillover effects. That was a pretty persuasive argument. And then, of course, all of you chimed in pretty persuasively on affirming the Second Amendment right to carry a gun, even to a protest. That deserves to be said. We're going to come to a close here in a few minutes. Would any of you like to make a final observation about any of this Minnesota maelstrom?
Well, one of the things that troubles me is, are we going to have an independent, thorough investigation and holding of accountability? So various things have been said by the authorities, including the Department of Homeland Security is going to be in the lead and in charge of this, and then transferring over, well, no, the Justice Department's going to handle it, and that will include the FBI and, as needed, the Office of Civil Rights. And then there's the question of excluding state and local authorities from the investigation, from the evidence. Those are all things that trouble me. I hope they get resolved in a good way.
Thanks, Bill. Let's turn to Phil Magnus.
So I said the biggest troubling thing right now is just the rank hypocrisy that we're seeing across the board. I mean, it was mentioned in the discussion that Republicans that campaigned on gun rights are now suddenly carving out exemptions from the Second Amendment, whether it's Jeanine Pirro in the District of Columbia, which again has some of the most strict and onerous gun restrictions nationwide, mainly put in by Democratic governments prior to this. And now you have a Republican defending that, or Republicans questioning the right to bear arms. And then on the flip side, you have, although I think it's a good thing to see Democrats suddenly coming out in favor of the Second Amendment, my big question is like, well, where were you for the last 50 years? On all the other incidents that happened where people's gun rights were violated. And then at the same time, you see, even as Democrats nationally are suddenly rediscovering the Second Amendment, they're moving at the state level in Virginia in particular right now to restrict the Second Amendment. So that pure hypocrisy playing on all sides of the spectrum just reveals that people are making arguments of convenience rather than anything that's rooted in sound constitutional principle.
Right. Well stated. Well stated. Let's give the last word to Abby Hall.
So like my colleagues here, I'm similarly deeply disturbed by what we're seeing on a number of levels. And this is, it's an unfortunate kind of microcosm. And I tell people, when my research on militarization is relevant, it's never a good day. And so I long for my own work to be non-relevant. I will say that I think from looking at Minneapolis specifically, and maybe this is naive optimism on my part, but between what we're seeing in Minneapolis from the people of Minneapolis, the organization, the things which are more, you know, individualized of how people are exercising their First Amendment rights, how people are demonstrating their or using their voice, is really illustrative, again, of what is required for us to live within a free and democratic society. Living within a democracy is not a passive activity. It requires people to be responsible, to pay attention, to utilize the rights that they have, to push back when boundaries are pushed or when government entities, again, doesn't matter what level we're talking about, that they overstep. And so my hope is that people will recognize that Minneapolis is the moment right now, but the conversation is much broader. This isn't just about what's happening in Minneapolis, but has a much, much broader implication or set of implications. But it's up to everyday citizens to be paying attention to understand what their role is in this dynamic between citizens and government, but also recognizing the power that citizens have in saying, hey, what's happening right now, we don't consent to. Because ultimately, in order, again, for policies to be accepted and implemented, they have to be accepted or at least not rejected by the public. And so people should recognize that we have that type of power, but we have to know what we're doing. We have to appreciate it and we have to protect it.
Well stated. Thank you so much. We're grateful to our senior fellow, Dr. Abigail Hall, who also teaches at the University of Tampa. Thank you for joining us today, Abby.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Also, my senior fellow colleagues here at Independent Institute, Philip Magnus and Williamson Evers. Thank you, Phil. And thank you, Bill Evers.
Thank you, Graham.
All right. And I just invite our friends to visit our website, independent.org, where you can get a lot more information on this and other vital topics of the day. Come back for our next episode of Independent Conversations. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.